Hello, welcome to Playback Daily, pressing rewind on some RTE Radio 1 programmes from Monday, the 24th of February, the day we listened to things like this.
Now it's just changed, actually. The bus that said was due is now due in 8 minutes' time.
There's a huge amount of scrutiny on the candidates, differs largely from a general election in a number of ways, particularly because it's all focused on the candidate as opposed to political parties and their policies.
Monday, February 24th, marked the third anniversary of the Russian invasion of Ukraine. Morning Ireland spoke to Siobhan O'Grady, Ukraine correspondent of the Washington Post. But first, Audrey Carvel gave us some of the facts and figures about the last 3 years of horror.
3 years ago today, in the very early hours of the morning, the people of Ukraine woke up to their neighbour Russia sending its soldiers across its sovereign borders. The full-scale invasion had begun. In the months that followed, hundreds of thousands died, millions left, 4 million moved within Ukraine, nearly 7 million left the country altogether. Towns and cities like Bucha, Irpin, Mariupol, they became bywords for horror as Russian troops and mercenaries raped, tortured and murdered their way through. Vladimir Putin used starvation as a weapon too, leaving people with no food, water, heat and light for weeks on end. Ukraine resisted strongly, but 3 years and 1,097 days of war later, Russia controls around 20% of its territory. And now Putin is being brought in from the cold, rehabilitated by US President Donald Trump, who has begun talks to end the war exclusively with the Russian president, leaving out Ukraine and European leaders. Let's go to the Ukrainian capital, Kyiv, now and talk to Siobhan O'Grady, chief Ukraine correspondent with the Washington Post. Siobhan, thanks for joining us. What does the capital look like today compared to this day 3 years ago and the days that followed?
I was here three years ago, and it's still shocking to me how long it's been just hearing you say just how many days it's been. I mean, so much has changed and so much remains the same. Kyiv is still under Ukrainian control. Most of the city remains completely intact because of air defenses and the remarkable bravery of Ukrainian service people who have defended the city for 3 years. We've seen statements, of course, from Donald Trump in recent days saying that so much of the country looks like a demolition zone, and that is just not true. Of course, on the front lines, we see huge damage, and we see that Russia has never taken control of a city without basically flattening it first. But the cities that remain in Ukrainian hands are vibrant and active. This morning, I woke up to my street blocked off in the capital because motorcades were coming by filled with European leaders who are here to meet President Zelensky today. He spoke yesterday at a large press conference marking 3 years of full-scale war, and he said that there would be a huge show of support today in Kyiv, with especially Baltic leaders here for meetings and dozens of others joining online to show their support for Ukraine. So the city remains strong. Life goes on as normal. People are going to work today, heading to school. But of course, on the front line, we know the fight continues in the east.
Well, indeed. And the people in Kyiv and all the other towns and cities across Ukraine, and particularly those still fighting in the east, they all must be completely exhausted by war.
Yes, of course. I mean, everyone's lives have just changed so dramatically. It's hard to even remember who anyone was before February 24th, 2022. And of course, a lot of those soldiers have been fighting without relief. Some of them have only had short breaks, if they're lucky, since the first days of war 3 years ago, because there is this lack of manpower still. And there's no end date when someone signs up to fight. There's no possibility of demobilization at this time because they just don't have enough people to replace them. And so that's become a largest issue in Ukrainian society. As we look at how long the war may drag on, that people on the front line really, really want a break. And we see even at times amputees going back to fight, of course, by their own accord. But others are just desperate for a break and know that if they don't fight, no one else will. And so they don't really have a choice.
And those towns and cities that I mentioned, Bucha, Irpin, Mariupol, so many others as well, that we all became so familiar with in the last 3 years, what has become of them in that time?
Bucha and Irpin have both made remarkable recoveries, in part thanks to huge donations to help rebuild. I mean, the main road in Bucha, where we saw the bodies of civilians scattered throughout who had been executed point blank by Russian troops in 2022, and all of the houses there had been destroyed. They're now rebuilt, and life is going on as normal. Schools are open, restaurants are open. Of course, there are still some reminders. The Ukrainians left the famous bridge that was destroyed in 2022 that separated Irpin from Kyiv, where we watched as thousands of people walked on foot, some holding homemade white flags to signal that they were civilians. I mean, the scenes that I remember witnessing at that bridge have haunted me and stayed with me, of elderly people being carried in bed sheets, children being carried by men who were holding a child on one hip and a gun on the other. I mean, we just saw total devastation there. Families were killed trying to cross that bridge. So that bridge has remained, although another one has been built next to it. But just as a reminder that Kyiv is not far from the front lines of this war, and that Putin's ultimate goal was to seize control of Kyiv. He failed. He thought it would be 3 days. He thought, then he said a week, then a month. And of course, 3 years later, Kyiv still stands. And we see a huge show of solidarity today from Europe, with so many leaders here to bolster Zelensky at a time when Ukraine's most important ally is faltering, and it's not totally clear whether the United States will remain on Zelensky's side. Yesterday, speaking at that press conference in Kyiv, Zelensky spoke for 2 hours. And he said that there would be disbelief at the United States if Trump were to meet Putin before he meets Zelensky. And he said, I'd really like for him to be on our side, and that for Washington to play the role of a mediator is not enough. That was a quote. And it's shocking to even hear those words, because to hear that Ukraine has to say, I'd really like for America to be on our side, I mean, that would have just been unimaginable just even a few weeks ago.
And Siobhan, what about the people in Kyiv and across Ukraine? Are they scared of what might come with these talks between the United States and Russia? Do they want a peace deal? Do they want the war to end, even if
Absolutely.
It means giving up much of their country, or not?
I don't think that there is appetite to give up any territory, although I think people are very exhausted. What they want is for the peace to be determined on Ukraine's terms. And that is what Zelensky emphasized yesterday, too, that this isn't a situation where Ukraine needs to be invited to the table. It is Ukraine's table. And that's what he said, that it's Ukraine who should be deciding and at the center of these conversations, not some afterthought when it's Ukraine's land and people whose lives are on the line. Of course, we've seen polling that that there is appetite for the war to end, even if it meant freezing the lines as they stand now. But it's hard to imagine that all of the people, especially the people who have fought on the front lines and are now unable to return home because their hometowns are occupied by Russians, it's really hard to imagine that they would easily agree to any kind of deal that meant that they would never return home. Mm-hmm. And I think what people are most afraid of is any kind of deal being foisted upon Ukraine, especially without security guarantees. And Zelensky really pushed for this yesterday, that although Trump administration officials have said that any NATO invitation remains very unlikely, that Ukraine should not be relying on that kind of idea as a way to end the war, Zelensky insisted yesterday that is still on the table. And he even said that if a NATO invitation came, that he would step down because of all of this discussion in recent days, especially by Russia and by the United States, that he needs to hold elections. And he said that he would be willing to step aside if a NATO invitation came.
Well, whether or not Ireland can or should be part of any peacekeeping efforts on the ground in Ukraine on the proviso of an eventual ceasefire was debated on Today with Claire Byrne.
Taoiseach and Foreign Affairs Minister Simon Harris is set to bring proposals to Cabinet next month that would amend the triple lock. Now, under the measure, the Dáil, the government and the United Nations must approve the deployment of 12 or more Irish troops overseas. The government is seeking to remove a veto held by permanent members on the UN Security Council, which prevents overseas deployments. Well, joining me now for more on this is Sinead Gibney, Social Democrats TD for Dublin Rathdown, and Malcolm Byrne, who's Fianna Fáil TD for Wicklow Wexford. And good morning to you both. Sinead, I'll start with you on this. I mean, in your opinion, would scrapping the triple lock threaten our neutrality? Is that what it comes down to for you?
Yeah, it is that simple. It's fundamental. Our neutrality and the triple lock are intricately integrated. I mean, they were The triple lock came about, if people recall, as a result of the Lisbon treaties and the concern of the Irish population that being cementing our EU membership that bit further would ultimately threaten our neutrality. And so the triple lock was devised as a way to protect that multilateralism which it now holds, which means that besides the two steps of approval at domestic level, we have a third step of approval, which means that it goes to the UN Security Council. And that really feeds into the principles of multilateralism that were a part of the establishment of the UN post-Second World War. And for me, I think that means that as an EU member state, as one of four countries who are neutral within the EU, it allows us to continue to maintain our neutrality and operate as an EU member state without concern over that. So I think at a time when we are seeing increasing global conflict, geopolitical instability, it is more important than ever that we protect our neutrality. Mm. And to me, removal of that third step fundamentally alters the triple lock. And that seems to be what the government are putting forward. Now, of course, it's only going to cabinet. We have yet to see a heads of bill on this. So we need to see the detail on it. I fully accept that.
But from what we know so far, this is where we seem to be headed, that the triple lock would be reformed. So Malcolm, to bring you in on that, I mean, do you believe, or what's your response to this argument that this would impact our neutrality?
Well, good morning, Claire. And I would agree with Sinead in that Irish foreign policy must continue to be committed towards multilateralism, that our foreign policy, while we have been militarily non-aligned, we never have been politically non-aligned, and our approach to international conflict has always been based on those Irish values around human rights, the rule of law, and protection of democracy. The difficulty that's there is that actually what the triple lock does is it restricts Ireland's ability to be able to express those views through participation in peacekeeping. So currently, and this is certainly something that would continue to be the case, that if Ireland wanted to take part in a peacekeeping mission, it needs to get the approval, obviously a proposal from government, it needs the approval of the Dáil. But there is the difficulty under the triple lock that one of the permanent members of the UN Security Council, and there are five, Russia, the United States, China, France and the UK, that if one of those exercised a veto, it would prevent Ireland from taking part in a peacekeeping mission. And this has happened, in 2003, when it was proposed that there would be a peacekeeping mission in the former Yugoslav Republic of Macedonia, now North Macedonia. Ireland wanted to take part in peacekeeping at the time, but China opposed it. And because China is one of the permanent members of the UN Security Council, Ireland couldn't take part. And given some of the horrific global conflicts we see at the moment, this today, of course, is the third anniversary of Putin's brutal invasion and unlawful invasion of Ukraine, or given the horrors that we see in the Middle East, that if Ireland, in line with our values that we have always expressed and our support for multilateral institutions, I believe that if a peacekeeping mission is to be considered for Ukraine or for the Middle East, that Ireland should be allowed to participate, and we shouldn't have our sovereign decision to do that challenged by a potential veto in the case of Russia, Ukraine or the United States in the Middle East.
Yeah, but why now? Why is it really important to do this now and not back, you know, when this happened before? You mentioned the example in 2003.
Well, there's been, I suppose the world has been changing quite a lot over the last number of years. We didn't see, the Russian invasion of Ukraine. We've seen now also the traditional transatlantic relationship between Europe and the United States under threat. And indeed, Friedrich Merz, who is likely to be the new German chancellor, who would be, very strongly supportive of the transatlantic alliance. If you listen to some of his initial comments, he's seriously concerned about peace and security in Europe.
But it was you guys in Fianna Fáil who wanted to hold firm to this, because in 2013, when Micheál Martin was opposition leader, this was raised, that the government at the time wanted to water down Ireland's commitment to the triple lock. And it was Micheál Martin who described it at the time as being at the core of our neutrality. So what's changed for Fianna Fáil?
Well, what the Taoiseach has outlined is that circumstances have changed. And core to Fianna Fáil's belief is about the importance of multilateralism, about support for the United Nations, for the European Union and for the values that I outlined. And in the current context of global affairs, I don't think, and Fianna Fáil doesn't think, that our defence and security policy, that our hands should be tied because of the potential veto of, you know, one of five members.
But you're the party who said that the triple lock was core to our neutrality. And you said that the argument about, you know, countries vetoing our attempts to send peacekeepers, that that was the efforts of a wing of Fine Gael to erode neutrality over the years.
But this is not about, let's be clear, this is not about Ireland, because in the context of the discussion at the time, this was about Ireland, you know, potentially being considered as some part of a military alliance or so on. Let's be very clear, that is not on the table. And if you look at what's being...
But if you separate out the triple lock, which your party said at the time was core to our neutrality, now are you saying it's not, or that circumstances have changed and we have to change our stance on neutrality?
Yeah, and when circumstances...
So you are saying we need to change our stance on neutrality?
Yeah. No. What we're saying is we are continued to be committed to a non-aligned policy with regard to military action. So we're not going to be involved in any military alliance. But when it comes to peacekeeping and when it comes to supporting Irish principles at a European and an international level, then those values that we think are important need to be expressed. Mm-hmm. And it needs to be seen in the context of, if we read the programme for government, which is quite extensive, it talks about, you know, first of all, that there is to be a new Oireachtas Committee on Defence and Security, which we haven't had before. There is a cabinet a committee now on security to review our security operations within the state. We're dealing with new challenges around cybersecurity as well. But the key argument here,
and you've heard it from Sinead, she believes that the triple lock is fundamental to our neutrality. Are you saying, just to be really clear, that it's not?
It's not fundamental to our non-alignment, because frankly, and this is why...
But it was, according to Fianna Fáil, some time ago.
But at the time we weren't facing the kind of challenges we do now, with the potential for where we will see the need for peacekeeping operations around the world, with the potential for particularly Russia, China, and indeed the United States vetoing particular decisions. And frankly, in terms of Ireland's current position, I believe that it should be the Dáil and the elected mm-hmm. representatives of the people of Ireland who decide
Sinead
our Ireland's
security
policy.
Sinead is here in front of me, Malcolm, shaking her head. Why, Sinead?
Because, I mean, I suppose if I can start maybe by just talking about the UN, as Malcolm has highlighted, there are issues there, and we don't deny that there are issues there, but rather than walking away from the UN at a time when it, as an institution, and the standards that it upholds as our global, you know, maintainer of peace, if you like, this is not the time for us to say, no thanks, it's not working, we're going to go this on our own.
But it's not working in this context because Russia or China or the United States can veto our decision to deploy forces over 12 in number.
And that's why we support broader UN reform, but it's about engaging with the UN and explaining and negotiating as to a better process by which this can happen. There is precedent for UN reform where, besides membership and procedural reform, there are ways in which we can adjust the mechanisms to actually work for us. But what it maintains is that multilateralism, because if we bring it back to just domestic level, then essentially we are retreating back to the regional blocs that existed before World War II, and allowing those global those standards and those structures to really fall apart around us. And that, for me, is the issue. The multilateralism is a fundamental part of our neutrality, and the removal of the triple lock threatens that multilateralism.
So what is the consequence of that, in your view? What's your fear?
Well, I think it's also important to highlight the context in which this is happening, because I think you're right. It's just simply the case that both the Taoiseach and the Taoiseach, so the two government parties, have moved from a point where they say that the triple lock is fundamental to our neutrality to a point now where they're saying that it is not. But there are other things at play here. So I welcome government spokespeople telling us that they hold neutrality dear, that they recognise the mandate of the Irish people and its commitment to neutrality. But unfortunately, behind the scenes, we are seeing movements that really undermine that. We are seeing munitions move through Irish airspace. We are seeing, and of course, it's important to point out that Fine Gael is a member of the EPP, which is led by von der Leyen and really kind of supports that militarisation of Europe. For me, this is the time to double down. We should be, you know, putting into the constitution our principle of neutrality as a country. And we then become an asset within the European Union respected for our neutrality and able to operate within that context.
Would it be fair to say that you believe Fianna Fáil are being led by the nose by Fine Gael on this?
I have no idea who's leading who in within the government parties, but it certainly seems to me that
I've given examples from the past where Fianna Fáil have stood firm against Fine Gael's moves to do this in recent years. Now they seem to be at one.
Well, they certainly are at one. There's no question there. I would not assume to, like, I have no idea why they're moving on this internally, why Micheál Martin has gone from saying not only that the triple lock is central to our neutrality, but also that we should not abandon the UN. He's quoted as saying that. And now he's saying the very opposite, that we should walk away from it and that we should keep those two features of the triple lock, which just it is no longer the triple lock. Mm-hmm. But for me, there are, as I mentioned, four countries within the EU that are neutral. It is about us doubling down on that neutrality and absolutely investing in our defence forces. And as a party, we support the same level of funding at level two that the review group determined, which means that we will be able to recruit and retain staff. We will be able to operate our defence forces appropriately and maintain that neutrality. Because I think oftentimes what's happening is there's conflation where people are saying, and I've seen opinion pieces about this, that we're ridiculed on the world stage. And that's not the case. We are ridiculed at the moment because our defence forces are in such a bad place. But our neutrality doesn't have to be ridiculed. And if we actually operate with all of these things from the principle of neutrality, I think we can have a much more mature debate and discussion around it.
Malcolm, can you address that argument that Sinead has made there, that if we do this, we risk undermining the structures of the UN, and now is not the time to do that?
Well, first of all, the government is deeply committed to the United Nations. There's a very clear and long commitment within the programme for government on support for the UN and supporting multilateralism. Ours has been an active diplomacy, and, unlike the Social Democrats who engage in gesture politics and say that we should boycott Washington, D.C. during St. Patrick's Week, we believe in actually engaging with the United States around some of these multilateral issues that are critically important. And I'm quite certain in terms of issues in the Middle East and Ukraine that Micheál Martin will bring it up with not just President Trump, but with the other meetings that go on during the week. So you cannot say that you're committed to multilateralism while at the same time, calling for a boycott of engagement with particular world leaders. As a government, we've always been very serious and taken Ireland's defence and security very seriously. And the challenge that we're going to face over the next number of years is if peace holds in the Middle East, which we all hope it will, and if we move to some sort of resolution in Ukraine where the sovereignty of Ukraine is respected, there may be a need for some peace maintenance operations in those places.
What we're saying to the UN is we don't agree with how your rules work, so we're going to take our ball and take the triple lock and bring this home, bring this decision home. I mean, it's hard to argue against someone who would say that you're undermining the structures. Rather than trying to work on reform from within, you're saying, no, we're out of that structure.
No, what we're saying is, and if you read the programme for government, what it says very clearly, and I'll quote, we support the United Nations, and we say about the UN, and I quote, that we will champion support for multilateralism and a fair rules-based international order at a time when multilateralism has been weakened. So here is our question, though, that let's say that there is a decision around peace maintenance in Ukraine in the coming years. The Irish government, along with the Dáil, supports the principle in terms of Ireland being supportive in some way. It goes before the UN. Russia exercises its veto at Security Council level. Should that then, under the triple lock, prevent Ireland from contributing and participating? I believe we have to continue to show the strong solidarity that we have done to the people of Ukraine. I think similarly, in terms of in the Middle East, we have to look at, should the US be allowed to exercise a veto? I think it's about Irish sovereignty and us having a serious conversation about defence and security in the 21st century.
I'm going to leave that there, but thank you both, Malcolm Byrne from Fianna Fáil and Sinead Gibney from the Social Democrats.
Staying with Clare, she spoke to Rome correspondent of the Daily Telegraph, Nick Squires, about Pope Francis and how the hospital that has treated the heads of the Catholic Church was dubbed by a previous pontiff as Vatican III. But first, Brian O'Connell spoke to some mass-goers in Cork about Pope Francis.
Are you keeping him in your thoughts?
We are indeed, yeah. Keeping him in our prayers.
I think he's been very good, and he's been trying his best to do his best. So, yeah, I think he's been good, and I just keep him in my prayers.
So you're heading into early Mass this morning?
Very early, every morning.
You're keeping him in your thoughts this morning?
Oh, I pray for him every morning. I always do.
Always do, yeah.
I know he's not well, like, you know. I'll obviously say a prayer, like, you know, but like, he is sick, he's very ill, you know. Look, I say a prayer for him, that's all we can do, you know. I think when it's your time, the man above called you. Simple as that, you know.
So when you were going in this morning now, you'd be thinking of him?
I'll just say a prayer, that's all. You know, I'll just say a prayer. And other people, like my peers that have passed away, and for those that are sick at the moment, like, you know. But it's a tough role, like.
Brian O'Connell there speaking to Massgoers in Cork earlier. Let's get more on this now. Nick Squires joins us, Rome correspondent with the Daily Telegraph. So, Nick, we are hearing twice daily from the Vatican. We're getting updates about the Pope's condition. He's still in hospital, still critical, we believe. And he is facing, isn't he, a complex set of medical issues?
Yes, he really is. It's been, just to sort of recap, it's been a bit of a roller coaster past 48 hours, the weekend, because on Saturday morning, the Italian press was full of cardinals and senior church figures here in Rome saying enough with the speculation about resignation or death. The Pope's, he's getting better. We hope that he'll be out of the Gemelli Hospital in a few days. So we were reporting on that. And then, of course, Saturday night, this kind of bombshell communique from the Holy See saying that, in fact, he was in a critical condition, that he'd had blood transfusions, that he was on oxygen. And then yesterday, another a bit of a shock, saying that he is suffering from what the Vatican called mild renal insufficiency, or sort of early stages of kidney failure, it seems. So, yeah, he's and as you know, he's got double pneumonia. He's got pneumonia in both lungs. So he's facing a number of challenges, absolutely. Mm-hmm.
But then, you know, the latest update is that he slept and rested well overnight. That was the latest one. We heard yesterday that he attended Mass in the morning. So it's difficult in a way to get a read on this situation, is it?
I think you're absolutely right. It's very difficult. And the communique this morning at about 8 o'clock Rome time was extremely brief. It said in Italian, the night passed well, the Pope slept and is resting, and that's it. There was no more information at the time. So given that we know he's facing this range of pretty serious health conditions, it's hard to know exactly where we're at. There is a fear that things could develop into sepsis, which is an infection. And that's something that can happen as a complication of pneumonia. Now, there's been no mention officially of sepsis, but certainly doctors are saying that that could be one possible consequence.
Mm-hmm. And that fear over the respiratory crisis that he had, that seems to have passed, and there hasn't been a repeat of that, has there? Not that we know.
That's right. The Vatican has said there's not been a repeat of that respiratory crisis, as they called it on Saturday. That seems to have been a pretty serious event on Saturday morning. So good news to the extent that that has not been repeated.
Mm-hmm. So tell us a little bit then around what's happening around this in the Vatican. What do you know about how this is being handled and dealt with, and what sort of activity is happening in the background?
I mean, it's always a little bit hard to discern exactly what's happening in the corridors of power of the Vatican. Anyone who's seen the film Conclave, which picked up those awards yesterday, will perhaps understand that. Certainly, lots of cardinals are coming out and expressing very loyal and sort of comforting views towards the Pope, saying, look, you know, we very much hope that he'll get better. We're praying for him. He's been in hospital for 10 days. He has been in hospital, of course, before this, during his papacy, for various ailments. We've long known that he has that he had part of one lung removed when he was a young man in Argentina. He's frequently in a wheelchair when he appears in public. So this is not new, but clearly this health crisis is something of a different magnitude.
Mm-hmm. And a word about the Gemelli Hospital, Nick. This is the same hospital that helped save Pope John Paul's life after the failed assassination attempt. It's also the Catholic teaching hospital, isn't it? And it has a papal suite there.
That's right. There's a papal suite there. Yeah, it's sort of commonly referred to as the papal hospital. John Paul II, I think, joked and nicknamed it Vatican III on the basis that Vatican I was the Vatican itself. Vatican II would be Castel Gandolfo, which is the summer residence traditionally used by the popes. And Gemelli, the hospital, became Vatican III because John Paul II spent so much time there. So Pope Francis will be, of course, getting the best medical care, but he's 88. He's got all these medical conditions, and he's pushed himself so hard during his papacy. We hear from lots of biographers and insiders that he's a hardworking but very stubborn man who hasn't wanted to ease up on the level of his engagements and commitments. And he's done some extraordinary foreign trips. Just last year, there was one that took him to Papua New Guinea and Singapore, East Timor, Indonesia. So it's a very workload for a man of 88. Mm.
And a word about the communication from the Vatican. Given your experience, does it appear to you that they're releasing a lot more information that we might have seen in the past when we heard about other popes who were going through similar health conditions? Do you feel that there's more information coming through to the public in this case?
I think it is. Yeah, I think you're right on that. It's been very obtuse in the past, but this is more transparent, I would say. And we understand that has come directly from Pope Francis himself, who has said, I don't want there to be any lack of transparency. I'm the Pope, but I am mortal, I'm a man, and I want people to know what's going on with my action. So don't hide stuff from people.
If you're a renter, you probably don't need to be told the rates being charged for the limited supply of homes across the country only goes up as opposed to down. But the latest report on the sector shines a light on just how far up those rents are actually going. I'll let Karen Creed on Morning Ireland bring you the bad news.
It shows that rents rose by an average of 5.7% last year, pushing the average monthly rent to just under €2,000 a month. It also shows that rental availability is down 25% compared to the time on 2023. These latest figures come as the government is being criticised over plans to consider proposals to phase out rent pressure zones. We can speak now to Ronan Lyons. He's author of the Daft.ie report and economist at Trinity College Dublin. Good morning, Ronan. This latest report we see shows really it's only getting more difficult for those seeking to rent or who may want to move to rent elsewhere.
That's right. Yeah, 2024 was another difficult year in the rental sector. Well, maybe not overall as tight as 2022 and 2023. There were still significant increases in rents. On average across the country, rents up almost 6%. And what we had seen in 22 and 23 was much less pressure in Dublin than elsewhere as a wave of new rental supply came on stream. That pipeline is more or less finishing up, and we can see renewed pressure in the capital with rents up 4% in 2024, and they're up about 6% outside of Dublin. Although there are some notable exceptions in Limerick, Limerick City rents are up almost 20% year on year.
And looking at the rent pressure zones, there's been so much focus on it. Many tenants rely on them, but these rental controls where these rent increases are capped, do you think they are still helping more people than hindering the market?
I think overall what's happened, especially since rent pressure zones were tightened in 2021, is that they're actually incurring a greater cost than the benefit. And what I mean by that is, if when you look at the impact on overall supply, there's been exits from the sector, and more importantly, there's been no new pipeline of rental housing over the next few years. And that's gonna hurt all renters, whether they're currently benefiting from rent pressure zones or not. And that's consistent with the evidence confidence in the rest of the world on the impact of rent controls. If they're not designed well, they can scare away the new supply that is actually the ultimate solution to why they were introduced in the first place. We introduced rent pressure zones because there was a lack of supply, and the idea was they were an emergency measure. But here we are almost 10 years on, and the supply challenge is actually worse than it was when they were introduced.
Can I ask you about the new Minister for Housing, James Brown's possible plans? Yesterday in an interview with the Sunday Independent, he referred to rent controls and the possibility of introducing reference rents. What exactly are they, and are they popular elsewhere, and have they worked?
So reference, this was a majority recommendation. Almost all of the Housing Commission's recommendations were unanimous. This was one where there was a difference of opinion. I was one of the three that couldn't sign off on that recommendation. So there's a footnote in the report with our view on it. The challenge with reference rents is that the evidence from elsewhere in Europe is that they do not have the required impact
well,
on supply.
Just for everyone, they may not know what reference rents are, but it is an average price range among a certain area, isn't it, of a rental?
Yeah, so for example, in the Dutch system, the rent is determined in part by the different features of the home. So how big it is, how many bathrooms it has, even down to the size of the countertop in the kitchen. So obviously those systems are significantly more administrative, as in there's a lot that has to go in, a lot of information has to go in to come out with that. And then, as you say, it's informed by rents elsewhere. But the concern that a number of us had in the commission was that if everything is being set with reference to everything else, where does the information come in about whether there's enough supply or not? And the more common system of rent controls, and one that has far less negative impacts on supply, is where rents are either new building is exempted from rent controls, or else rents are allowed reset when a tenant leaves. And either or both of those would actually have, even within the existing rent pressure zone system, would have far less of a negative impact on supply than what we've seen over the last 3-4 years.
A chat last week with Oliver Callan and his guests Linda Martin and Jason Byrne veered into a topic territory that we weren't expecting, the presidential election. Linda said she'd been approached by a political party to consider running for the role. That got the team on Today with Claire Byrne thinking and talking about the moves and machinations behind the race for the Oris.
It's the presidency, so what could be in store for the candidates who are thinking of throwing their hats into the ring in a campaign that has proven in the past to be very tough and often very personal? Well, for more on this, we're joined by broadcaster Cathal Mullany. Cathal, we're going to take a look at this upcoming vote, and it's a really important one for some political parties in particular. Why is that?
Yeah, so we're looking at this election later on in the year, Claire, in the autumn time, and you mentioned that it's important for some of the parties in particular, probably because we're on the back of elections pretty recently for the general election in the autumn of last year. So if we're to look at the political parties at the outset, for example, Fine Gael has never held the office of president. They've struggled in the last election that they contested back in 2011. So they would love to make an impact, I think, and probably win that, and it probably will be a big boost for Simon Harris as well, relatively new into the party leadership. You look at Sinn Féin, who contested the last election as well, didn't perform particularly well in 2018, and they would view it as an opportunity maybe to take hold of the presidency. And then it's going to be interesting, the wider left, whether they can agree a candidate. There has been talk about that, maybe between Labour and the Social Democrats, and the Green Party and Labour and the Soc Dems did quite well in the general election. So they'll be looking to build on the momentum. And then beyond all of the parties, there's bound to be one or two independents that will emerge from the woodwork and tend to do quite well in presidential elections.
So talk us through then the mechanics of it. Who can run? How do they get their names on the ballot paper?
So you've got to be over 35 years of age to contest the election. Now, that was subject of a referendum back in 2015 that was actually soundly beaten to reduce the age of eligibility back to 21. And in terms of receiving a nomination, you've got to be nominated by at least 20 members of the Oireachtas or 4 local authorities. So we have seen some independents go the local authority route, where they'll go around to different county councils around the country and make their case to be a candidate in the election. It is quite a rigorous process for them to go through, but you'd suspect that the parties within the Dáil will nominate their own candidates this time around.
Mm-hmm. So you would expect those conversations to be happening right now, and decisions very likely have been made by particularly the parties at this stage, would you say?
Yeah, I think definitely in the bigger parties, we've seen some names in the ether and in the media over the last couple of months now. It's probably been shortened the speculation because of the general election. Everybody was focused on that. But I think from now on, we're at the end of February now, we're looking at the election probably around the end of October. names will become much more prominent now. We've seen different things even in the media this week about different candidates emerging and different names emerging within the parties. There's likely to be further focus on it over the next couple of months. You're probably looking at for the party's selection conventions over the summertime and then the campaign to begin probably once the Dáil returns and the summer holidays are over in late August.
I mean, there are lengthy campaigns, aren't they?
And they're very difficult, as you mentioned at the outset. There's a huge amount of scrutiny on the candidates, differs largely from a general election in a number of ways, particularly because it's all focused on the candidate as opposed to political parties and their policies. That brings with it a huge, an enormous level of scrutiny on the candidates. Also, for independents, one of the things to consider is the resources that you've got available, because the spending limit, I think, is 750,000, which is an enormous amount of money. But when you consider the campaign has to be nationwide, so you've got to have quite a large public persona and name recognition, facial recognition, and the resources that you need behind you to run a campaign like that are quite significant. Mm-hmm. So that probably limits the amount of people that might consider going for it and giving it a right good go from an independent.
So it's really hard to do it. I mean, when you put that figure out there, it's really hard to do it as an independent.
It is. And then you've got to look at the parties as well. Their coffers will be depleted with the local and Europeans last year and the general election last year as well. But from an independent point of view, you're right. It is something that's difficult. Now, one thing that might work in independents' favour is we have seen a tendency from voters over a number of elections at presidential level, maybe that the voter loyalty towards the particular party they might vote for isn't quite as strong, and they might be more likely to vote for an independent in a presidential election.
So you mentioned that the campaigns are tough, really personal, as we said at the outset, and they often throw up unexpected events. You're going to talk us through some of those controversies now that we've seen in the past.
Yeah, so we've seen there's probably a controversy nearly attached to most of the presidential elections. In every election, something tends to catch fire from time to time. But if we're to look at some of the specifics over the years, if we go back to 1990 and Brian Lenihan Sr., who was looked at as almost a certainty to win that election campaign as the Fianna Fáil candidate, then controversy rose around his alleged involvement back in 1982 and whether calls were made to Áras an Uachtaráin and the then president Patrick Hillary around whether the Dáil would be dissolved or not and whether Fianna Fáil might get a chance to form a government without the need for an election when the coalition government collapsed. And then there were contrasting versions of events, and eventually Brian Lenihan was actually sacked by the Taoiseach Charles Haughey from government, and he went from being the favourite for that election, his support fell. Now, he actually did win the first preference vote in the end, but Mary Robinson managed to receive enough transfers to win in that election and take the presidency. So that was probably the largest controversy we can think of in the modern times.
So his name was still on the ballot when the presidential election happened, and that was all related to the mature recollection phrase, which people probably will remember, and it will jog memories around the country. Then we come to Sean Gallagher in 2011.
So we had the Tweetgate controversy then in 2011. Sean Gallagher, again, the candidate that probably came from a little bit from the blind side in terms of his ability to win that campaign. He was the favourite heading into the closing stages of the campaign, was performing very well in the opinion polls. And then we had the frontline debate here in RTE, where a tweet was read out purporting to be from an official account linked to Martin McGuinness's campaign, alleging that someone who had given Gallagher a cheque for a Fianna Fáil fundraiser a couple of years previously would be presented at a press conference a couple of days after. Then it turned out that that account wasn't linked to the Martin McGuinness campaign. RTE subsequently apologised to Sean Gallagher. He received what was described as substantial damages after that as well. But in terms of the election campaign, Sean Gallagher's support fell after that, and Michael D. Higgins actually won that election and then went on to win the 2018 election as well.
And then more recently, you mentioned 2018, Peter Casey ran in 2018, didn't he?
That's right. Peter Casey was involved in the 2018 election. Now, there was some controversy attached to that campaign as well, and comments around Peter Casey towards the traveller community and whether the ethnic minority status that they had was justified. And there were calls for Peter Casey to step out of the race. He actually didn't, and stayed in the race and finished second in the end in 2018 and polled quite respectably.
Mm-hmm. The office of president, I mean, it changes depending on who holds it. It's very much an office that people make their own.
Yeah, absolutely. And if you look at Michael D. Higgins, has been there since 2011. And some people would say that the presidency is above and beyond politics. But Michael D. Higgins has probably challenged that in terms of some of the comments that he's made. Some people would say in terms of comments on day-to-day political matters. It's difficult for, I think, candidates to carve out and explain just exactly what the presidency does in our current political system, because the Dáil and the government make the day-to-day political decisions. But the president is viewed as above politics, represents Ireland on the international stage, state visits, appoints the government. We've seen that recently with the change in government as well. It probably has been difficult to carve out a niche for the presidency in the current political climate. Mm-hmm. And that's probably a challenge that all the candidates will face later on in the year when they're putting their case to the people.
All right, so we're waiting for the names to emerge, but there are a few floating around already.
There are, and even this morning I was looking at the back of the Irish Independent, I think it was, Jarlett Burns, the GA president, was questioned whether he wanted to run for the presidency later in the year. He's ruled that out. Coming back to what we mentioned at the outset in terms of the political parties and Fine Gael looking to win the presidency for the first time, there's been a number of names linked to their potential candidacy there. You're looking at Mairead McGuinness, the former EU commissioner. Francis Fitzgerald has been mentioned. Heather Humphreys maybe as well. Bertie Ahern's name has been circulating around Fianna Fáil about whether he might run. Michael McDougall from an independent viewpoint. And I'm interested to see, Claire, to come back to the wider thing on the left, whether the Sog Dems, Labour and the Green Party can agree a candidate from that side of things in Leinster House and put together an agreed candidate, because that might point to something further down the road in terms of maybe government formation next time around, or whether they can build more of a common platform.
And didn't Linda Martin tell Oliver Callan last week that
That's
she's thinking about it as well, although we haven't been able to figure out who asked her. She says a political party did, but there'll be names like that that crop up who we just will not be expecting.
And they could be names that could do quite well, because the presidency, as I say, is different to voting in a general election, and people might be attracted by the fact that someone might come from outside of politics to try and win the presidency and represent the people of Ireland without having that political background, as it were.
All right. Well, look, that'll whet the appetites of the political nerds. Cathal, thanks so much for coming in.
Never mind getting to the Oris. Some people just want to get to work on time. But ghost buses, and no, I don't mean those with wannabe actors jumping around talking about ghoulish goings-on, but actual buses that are supposed to turn up for passengers, but don't. Claire has the proper explanation.
There has been a large increase in complaints recently about the issue, and a focus also on routes operated by Go Ahead Ireland. Well, Brian O'Connell has been looking at this for us. And Brian, this has come up a lot in recent years, hasn't it?
Well, it has. I think probably, Claire, since those digital displays at bus stops had been introduced, and we were quite slow in Ireland compared to some countries to bring them in. But there has been some disparity at times between when your bus arrives, when the display at the bus stop says it will arrive, and that's if it arrives at all. You can obviously check on the TFI Live app, but again, the information sometimes isn't fully accurate. Everyone accepts, I suppose, buses can be delayed. We looked at congestion last week in places such as Dublin, Cork, Galway. It's a very significant issue, and it obviously causes problems for timetabling. But the issue of no-show buses is one that is, as you said, getting a lot of political focus. And it's not just politicians who are frustrated by this and commuters. I spent time with a third-year MTU student, Sasha Matishkin, and he has put his studies to very good use, I can tell you. I'll tell you about that in a minute. But first of all, we stood outside MTU, the third level college, last week at one of the main bus stops. And this is just a sense of how we got on.
So after you finish your college, you still have to wait for a bus, and it might take like almost 2 hours sometimes.
We're waiting on the 205, which goes from Bishopstown here into Kent Station in Cork. It's telling us right now that it's due. Looking up the road here, I don't see any bus coming.
No, it's not here. I guess we could try TFI Live. It's a nice app that Bus Aaron provided us, so we can check.
Well, now it's just changed, actually. The bus that said was due is now due in 8 minutes' time.
That's called ghost buses. That's what we call ghost buses.
That's called a ghost bus.
Yes, it says that it will come in a minute, but then it disappears on the timetable.
Like Marie Celeste.
Yes, so now we can report it as a missing bus.
See, so that bus which was due now is now due in 7 minutes. Then there's a bus due in 22 minutes, there's a bus due in 27 minutes, and in 52 minutes.
Yes. Okay, it's come up again.
So now we can see, just as you're speaking, the digital display is saying it's due. Now it's saying, it just changes every couple of seconds. Now it's saying 6 minutes it's going to be here.
Yeah.
It can't really make up its mind, can it, Sasha?
Yes, that's the problem. It's kind of very helpful to see a time when the bus can come.
Well, now it's changed again. It's saying that the bus is here.
Yeah.
And here comes the bus, actually. I can see a double-decker bus coming around the corner. Although it's saying it's due in 6 minutes, it's actually arriving now.
Yeah, so I'm not sure if it's the next bus.
You checked the TFI app.
That's a TFI Live.
Okay,
yeah.
This is TFI Live.
So we have one bus due. Probably that's one that's coming.
Even though the display is telling us 6 minutes.
Yeah.
Well, it could be down to traffic congestion or roadworks, but Sasha turned his frustration into something tangible.
He did. He's studying software development, and why not put his skills to good use, Claire? Just over a week ago, what did he do? He set up a website, nobus.omiti.net. So it's really an online portal where people can upload issues and frustrations with the bus service in your local area. So he's doing this, he says, to try and help bus companies with more accurate information and then to analyse the most reported routes and times.
So the website is called nobus.omiti.net. That's where you can find it. Basically, you have to enter the bus number, location, pick today's date and time. That's it. You just submit it and it will go to the database. And we hope to analyze the data, and we hope that this analyzed data will help the bus area to improve bus service.
So this website went live a week ago. What's the reaction been like?
So I was really delighted that it's gained attention. It got 15,000 viewers.
So how many people reported issues with their buses?
I would say we have close to 200 reports.
So 200 issues, ghost buses, no-shows, delayed buses in a number of days.
Yes. So I start reading those reports and people start providing what happened with the bus.
Yeah.
And I was really upset.
Give me some of the examples.
So one of the worst for me when I got really upset, when somebody shared their report, they said that they were late for work and they had a warning for being late. And obviously it happened because of the bus, not because of the laziness or of somebody. They got a warning from work for being late. It really has an impact on their life.
Now, you got some listeners, Brian, to send you their frustrations.
I did. I just gathered some of the frustrations with ghost buses and no-show buses from some listeners in both Dublin and Cork, Clare. So this is some of what they had to say.
So basically, I live in Douglas. And to get to work in the morning, I'd have access to the 220 bus and the 216 bus. The bus has been harder and harder to get in the morning, where basically any time after 7:30 are full, meaning you're waiting for a bus at possibly 8:45 and you're not getting in for 9 o'clock. I just drive in to just outside the city centre and walk the last 10 minutes. Otherwise, at the weekends, it's a bit more reliable. The app would show up buses that are apparently due and don't actually turn up.
I'm a frequent user of the TFI app. I have disregarded the information that it gives me in relation to one bus in particular that I get. The latest thing seems to be that it's coming early rather than the time that's indicated on the app. The Dublin bus routes that I use are mainly accurate in relation to real time, but the go-ahead ones are seriously lacking. Don't understand where they go. 1 minute they can be three stops away and the next minute they vanish into the ether. There must be a big Bermuda Triangle for buses somewhere in Dublin, and I'd love to know where it is.
The ghost bus thing is kind of getting out of hand, because even with all of these updates being done to the real-time info and having live tracking, even a bus that if it comes up as cancelled, it'll still show up. So there's a lot of discrepancy in terms of being able to plan ahead. I can't guarantee that I'm going to make it into work on time in case I get to the bus stop and then the bus suddenly decides it's not going to show up. But you shouldn't have to plan ahead to give yourself an hour buffer in case a bus doesn't show up.
So that's Ryan, Sarah and Olivia there. Well, politically, as you said, Brian, at the beginning, this has been getting a lot of attention.
Just over a week ago, Transport Minister Dara O'Brien confirmed a detailed review is now underway regarding a number of buses that have been failing to show up. And these are under Go Ahead Ireland's operation. They run a number of routes in Dublin. So the review was ordered following concerning complaints from passengers about disappearing services that we've been highlighting there, some of them in the greater Dublin area. Paul Murphy, who's People Before Profit TD for Dublin's Southwest, he believes Go Ahead should not be given any new routes. This is some of what he told me.
Nobody expects 100% perfect service. Every bus arrives throughout the day, you know, exactly on time all the time. But it's clear that over the past couple of months, things have deteriorated very, very significantly. And it's striking that it is particular routes are much worse than others. So the ones that are coming to me most consistently are the S6, the S8 and the S4. And there are other issues. There's issues with the 77A, there's issues with the 27, but those S routes in particular, you know, this isn't some minor inconvenience. This is about getting to work. I've met multiple people who say I have to keep getting taxis in order to go to work. I mean, there's two issues. There's the no-show buses, which don't appear on the app, aren't meant to arrive and don't arrive. But and then there's the ghost buses, which are even worse, where they appear on the app, they're meant to be coming, and then they simply don't show. And that's even worse.
And where do you think the nub of the issue is, Paul? Is it that we don't have enough drivers? Is it congestion in the city centre? Is it that the technology is not reflective of the reality? It's out of date. Like, where is the main issue, Jim?
The significant deterioration seems to relate to issues of mechanics and bus drivers. And it's particularly bad in terms of go ahead. So the worst routes that come to me are all operated by go ahead as opposed to by Dublin Bus.
What's the solution here? What do you want to see done in the immediate next couple of weeks, months?
We shouldn't make it even worse. So unfortunately, it's being reported that Go Ahead is due to get another rake of routes. There should not be more routes going to Go Ahead. The other issues, again, some of them do relate to this kind of breakup of the system, where you have the NTA, you have TFI, then you have Dublin Bus, and then you've Go Ahead. Ultimately, we need more buses, we need more bus drivers, we need more mechanics. Like, that's what we need. But in the meantime, we're kind of making things harder for ourselves with some of the rules that are being applied. But in particular, this division, the separation out of what should be an integrated mechanism and the privatization and the giving of routes to go ahead is a big exacerbating issue of problems that might otherwise still exist, but to a lesser extent.
So you then went to the National Transport Authority and also Go Ahead for comment, Brian.
Well, I put especially Paul Murphy's criticisms to Go Ahead Ireland for comment, and they said recent service issues experienced have been due to a combination of factors: shortage of mechanics, as Paul Murphy referenced, across the transport sector, seasonal illnesses, for example. And they say these recent issues are temporary. They can confirm that there has been an improvement in the past 2 weeks, so they're up to about 97% to 98% of all kilometres and all of their routes now. One of those figures was down around 94%, so you can see an improvement there. And they say there are plans for recruitment. For example, they have a school of over 70 trainee drivers at the moment. 5 new colleagues are joining per week. They would like to apologise to passengers for recent service issues experienced, but again, they highlighted, Claire, over 98% of contracted kilometres across their network at the moment. So then I went to the National Transport Authority and just put a number of the issues and criticisms to them, especially around this real-time information. So these are the digital displays that you'll see at your bus stops. There is a new system being developed now around this. They said that their customer surveys show that there's an 83% satisfaction rate, and only 7% of customers in their surveys have showed that the real-time displays are not accurate. But notwithstanding that, there is this now new system being developed. There's been a contract awarded for a new system. So this will replace this. At the moment, there's 5 different types of systems being used for this real-time display. So perhaps that's where some of the issues are arising. So they're going to work closely with bus operators to ensure that this new system will be up and running. The system will enable the production of better quality dynamic real-time information, they tell me, for the app, and then the 800 plus on-street displays that are available. And then they pointed as well to those improvements that Go Ahead have acknowledged over the past 2 weeks, the 98% of kilometres contracted.
I think I'll walk home. That's your Playback Daily, with selections from shows that aired on RTE Radio 1 on Monday, the 24th of February. From me, Trevor Keegan, thanks for listening. Bye for now.